Welcome to the Colorado Review podcast, featuring prose and poetry from both recent and archived issues of the journal. Once a month, a rotating crew of editors and staff members are invited to read and discuss some favorite poems, stories, and essays as published at Colorado Review. I'm Kylan Rice, and for this episode, we have the special opportunity to speak with Emily Perez, the author of the book House of Sugar, House of Stone, which was published as a part of the Mountain West Poetry Series in 2016. All right, Emily, thank you so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you over Skype.
Oh, thanks so much for setting up the time and space for us to do this. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, well, I mean, and one of the reasons that we're on Skype, of course, is that this is our second time talking. We actually had a chance to interact at AWP Los Angeles.
Yes.
In March there?
Yes. I think the very end of March and beginning of April.
Right. And you know, technology is a bear. Ate the interview. And here we are again, trying one more time because we are persistent. If nothing else, we are persistent.
Right. And, you know, maybe we're slightly wiser people than we were then. We'll see.
Right. Exactly. So anyway, thank you. Thank you for that. So we've got a wonderful opportunity here to talk a little bit about your book, House of Sugar, House of Stone. Just before we begin, I'm curious, do you have anything that you think the audience should be aware of when it comes to sort of the general structure of the book, or maybe something that you would appreciate a listener having in mind or bearing in mind as we hear some of these poems?
Sure. So the poems... Many of the poems in this collection are about families and about relationships within families. And when I started the book, or when I started what was to become the book, I was writing a lot of these fairy tale poems. And then simultaneously, I was writing some more autobiographical poems about some things from family history, and then things that were more contemporary to me. And at the time that I was doing this writing, I thought of these sections, or I thought of these things as three very separate things. So there was this fairy tale world, there was the world of the past, and then there was the world of the present. And I was very rigid in my thinking about them. And friends would read my manuscript and say, you need to shake things up. These poems need to speak to each other instead of being so cordoned off. And I would heed their advice and know they were right. And I would do things that I titled radical revision, where I would take one poem from one section and move it to another section and be like, there, I did it. I really shook things up. So I got to a point where I realized I just was not able to do this on my own. I don't know what the mental block was, but I just was not able to see how to put these things together in a more productive way. And so I sent a draft of the manuscript to an editor, and she just completely mixed it up in a way that I don't even fully understand, but she achieved exactly the effect that I was looking for, which was basically to juxtapose these poems and to really call into question how is the fairy tale world the contemporary world, and how is the historical world a fairy tale, and how is and how do history and today speak to each other? So really just brought these things together so that they could bump up against each other and have much more productive tension than I had before. So that's a thing that I'm really excited about in having these poems in a collection together, is that now they have relationships with one another in a way that they didn't always.
Right. I love that idea that somehow just by placing them in apposition to one another, they sort of develop or accrue new meanings.
Yes.
And that kind of conversation begins to happen in maybe ways that was just subterranean before.
Yeah.
And
And what's also really provocative to me is that it sounds like this was almost kind of collaborative in the sense that the poems were curated by another mind. You know, they were kind of put into conversation with each other by someone other than you. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yes. And it's almost like someone else had to say to me, like, these are all the same conversation. You know, don't
Right.
think of these as three different conversations. And that shouldn't have been news to me, but and in a way it wasn't.
Right.
But it did take someone else to really get me there.
Why don't we hear a selection
Sure.
from the book? So here's Emily Perez reading from House of Sugar, House of Stone, published by the Center for Literary Publishing in 2016.
All right. I'll start with a poem called Under the Roof. This is a poem that I wrote while I lived in Seattle. And to me, there's something very Seattle about it, though I suppose if you were to actually locate it somewhere, it is more in that fairy tale German forest nebulous space where the Grimm brothers were collecting stories. Under the roof. Under the roof, the shingled roof, no. Under the eaves, the leaf-clawed eaves, no. Under the clouds, collecting slow, sloughing glass, glitter missives now. Under the evergreens that grow, over the snow where wolf feet go, feather light, nails tap ticking, frost clicking as pine needles ever fall and flow, those slivered, silvered spines of sap, sweet poison tipped, designed to stick, like silent wishes slipped under the snow by one who waits under the eye divine, measuring each gasp and murmur, the weight of days, the whims of weather, the webs of lovers, spells of spiders, throes, thralls, trembling of each quarry's cover, under the reach of the past and closer, under the gaze that hovers cold over the scene like a broad-winged hawk, the gaze that knows what never was, what never shall be, what lies shut, what's still beneath each breath and shudder. The next piece I'll read is called A New Mother Discovers Emptiness. And this is a piece that I wrote actually before I had children. And at the time that I wrote it, I really empathized with the children in it. And now that I've become a parent, I find that I empathize more or equally with the mother in it. And it's looking at it now, I'm surprised that I wrote it before my children were born, because it's almost, in a way, it's almost a predictive poem. A new mother discovers emptiness. That winter, I resigned my role as hope. With only two hands, smaller always than I'd needed, and twice as many yearning mouths to fill. I concocted stories, songs, and spells, and once we'd sucked the marrow clean from words, I spun, I wove, I kept conniving to confect, but there's only so much sweetness in the world. I poured pity on the two of them, just children still, all their pleasure flown. In each other's faces, we reflected want, so I sought solace on my own. I found it first within the darkness of the woods, which rendered me invisible. I found it next within the distance of the stars, whispering how minuscule, how meaningless my sorrows. Who insists on being heard when faced with all that space? What is emptiness when perched upon the lip of a black hole? I tried to teach those little ones to see. I pushed them toward the door. And when they would not go, I locked them out myself. Here's a pathway, here is bread, I said. You'll learn these walls were never real. Make a new home inside your head. To those who ask me, What if they are calling in the woods, I say, at least they've learned to sing. And to those who wonder, what if they're trembling with fear, I say, then at last they're full. The next piece I'll read is called Verge. Verge. Spring formed, honed, run ready. I was a switch almost thrown. I was a pulse quickening. I asked the wind, what do you know? I asked the wind to warn me. My shuttered eyes grew sensitive to figures framed in doorways. I slept with one ear always up, attuned to nighttime's yawn and creep. I slept with shoes upon my feet. I learned to dream of getaway, so even if but half awake, I'd move, and move precisely. I kept the burner on. I was coiled, I was quivered, I was cocked. I was a sudden summer storm gathering, ready to rage, then blow myself to droplets, diffuse, ungraspable. This piece is called Advice to My Younger Self, Winter. One night you will learn you are soon to be abandoned, cast outdoors. This news may cause you some alarm. Swallow it and savor those last hours. You'll have years to assign the anger, blame. For now, hold them close. They'll keep you warm. The day will start with a long hike. You'll receive a crust of bread, an afternoon's low fire, and you will take a nap, a few hours to believe you are still loved and maybe you misheard, but night falls and it's certain, you're forgotten, left to freeze, starve, be eaten alive by wolves. Allow yourself a moment's grief for all that's gone, your cat, your clothing, your warm bed. You may shed some tears, but don't cry loud or long. The cold will come. You'll need your energy. It helps to have a plan before you leave. On your voyage out, you can collect, then drop along the road the smoothest stones, the ones that reflect moonlight, make a lighted trail home. Or as the story goes, you could crumble up your crust of bread and leave a map, sure to be consumed by birds. It hardly matters. Either way, you're lost. Either way, you'll wander into deeper woods. Perfect wife. Be doing, be done. Be done unto, be under, be asunder, but holding strong. Be slow thighs, be patient eyes, be looking blindly at. Be a pretty putty tat. Be blank, be long, be sleek and strong enough for a woman, but made for a man. Be made for baking and tea, be pies cooling in the shade of sills and eaves. Be leaves leaflessly falling, be someone's true calling, be melonballing and drawling, be celebratory emotive syllabics, fantabulatics, dramatics, and static cling. Be anything that makes them sing. Be merry, be bright, be pearly froth and silky tights. Be flashbulbs popping on the stockings' glitter seam. Be cream, be dream, dream, dream. This next piece is called Little Song, and I wrote this piece when I was pregnant with my first son, and it's to me, it was about the experience of being pregnant, the good parts of it, which for me there weren't that many, but this is the sweet side of it. Little Song. Licorice, sweet gum, darkly hooded plum, flesh and pith kiss quick fish tongue, pearl and strung sky, purrs a purple plosive sigh, hiccups skip him nimbly off my sides, ribwalker from mung bean sprung, swelling seasons under sun, from tadpolite to parasite to nightlight giving hum. Impala wink on fox feet, rattlebox in rain, rigmarole, gravity pull, quintessential little universe, this shotgun riding hitchhiker on swiftly shifting, tilting, lifting track for blooming trains. Oh, leggy lamb of lamp glow, soon you'll swallow turquoise whole, soon you'll drink my eyes, my voice, soon you'll wind your spring run clock. Tonight, I heard your shadows in my flock.
That was Emily Perez reading from House of Sugar, House of Stone, selected for the Mountain West Poetry Series and published by the Center for Literary Publishing 2016. Thank you so much, Emily.
You're welcome.
So many things, encountering this collection again are coming to my mind. In particular, something that you just mentioned during your reading, and that is that the poem "Advice to My Younger Self, Winter," you found it was it almost forecasted your experience of motherhood.
Or that's actually more a new mother discovers emptiness. Yes.
Oh, a new mother discovers emptiness. I'm so sorry. Yes. So it sort of it cast into the future in ways that you weren't aware of maybe at the time of writing it. And that seems to be that's that kind of effect that I feel like poetry and the writing of poetry can have. That's something that I'm just curious about in general, and I'm curious if you've done any thinking about the ways in which the writing of poetry maybe feeds into your life as it's separate from poetry, and the ways in which they maybe are in conversation with each other in a two-way sort of fashion.
Sure.
And maybe just to add on to that is maybe that sounds similar to the ways in which these poems themselves are in conversation mm-hmm. with one another. So maybe you could just talk about like the conversational quote-unquote aspect of these poems, either among each other, among themselves, or between the poem and your life, separate from.
Sure. I'll start with the life question. So I'm a high school teacher, and high school poetry is, if as maybe anyone listening to this can think back to their own high school poetry, which is often kept in, kept hidden away, is often deeply, deeply autobiographical. But what I tell my students is that I will never assume that your poem is autobiographical. Because I find that even in my most seemingly autobiographical poems, what I'm doing is not a transcription or a confession. It's a performance of some aspect of myself. And it's often an exploration for me, for my own purposes, of some aspect of myself. Something else I tell my students is, not to ask, not to pose a question that you already know the answer to. And so I think in a way these poems are posing questions to me that I don't know the answers to. And I'm kind of working that out, or working out one possible answer. And so in terms of how these pieces are in conversation with my day-to-day life, I think that these pieces in a lot of ways are much darker than my day-to-day life, but they are performances or explorations of some of my deepest fears and anxieties. A friend of mine who blurbed the book, I think, put it better than I ever did, in saying, this is the poet Sasha West said, that the book asks, how do you wed and stay a self, and how do you both procreate and create? And I think those are some of the big questions that I grapple with, and that a lot of people who are artists and parents grapple with, and that I'm kind of working out different answers to that in these pieces. So I'd say that like the pieces, in a way, like are they in the way that they're predictive? Maybe they lay out several different possibilities, and so some of those possibilities resonate with my lived experience, but never completely. I at least I hope I'm not like the scary mother that I portray in my books, but you'll have to ask my kids about that.
Yeah.
In terms of the poems being in conversation with each other, I've really been fascinated with the idea of how the stories I read and the messages I received as a child about what it meant to be a girl in particular and what it meant to have a family, how literature shaped my idea of that and how I had to then kind of confront literature later in life and say, hey, literature, you were wrong, or, you know, you told the story this way and that's not the way it is. And so I think that's part of my interest in fairy tales as kind of these very early stories that tell us how things will be or how things might be. I'm still in conversation with those stories. And then my more contemporary, or the poems with the more contemporary settings are also conversing with those stories.
I love that somehow the fairy tale is this piece of writing or genre of writing that links past and future. You know, it comes deeply out of the past, but somehow speculates or imagines futures. And that seems like, in a strange way, they seem to like transect a life. They sort of like travel along a life as if that life was, you know, a wire or a resonating string.
Well, and I think, I mean, there's something fascinating about the ending, that the ending is this, the ending goes into infinity, right? They're happily ever after. And that's it. I mean, it's both like abruptly over and it's in perpetuity, right? Yeah. That the happiness goes on, and that's what they achieved, and that's what they worked for.
That's such a surprising way of saying that. You know, that somehow infinity is involved in the fairy tale. That's lovely. I think I'll take that with me. Now, you know, that last poem, Little Song, and really, I mean, on the subject of scary mom poems.
Sure.
You know, there's something, you know, that most famous of scary mom poets, Sylvia Plath, I feel like, I can't help but hear echoes of Morning Song in Little Song.
Yeah.
You know, love sets you going like a fat gold watch, you know, and the word clock is even used in Little Song. And so I want to return a little bit to this question asked by Sasha West on the back of your book. You know, how do you both procreate and create? Can you talk about perhaps just address some of the differences and similarities between these two generative states?
Sure. I mean, I have a poem about it to the artist child in the collection, where I'm basically warning my own child to run away before I decide to revise him or her.
Right.
And that the artist may prefer a type of art that he or she has complete control over. Whereas the child instantly, I mean, I want to say, you know, even at the moment of birth, the child, even before birth, the child is his or her own being. And despite a parent's best efforts, cannot be edited, you know. And so I think that's the wonderful thing, and also the scary thing. It's a matter of control, so that the poem is something that can be endlessly revised and reshaped and presented in different ways. I have control of when anyone gets to see it, and, you know, in what state, and the child is so out of my control, you know. But that's also the wonderful thing, is that the child is endlessly surprising and always evolving, whereas once the poem is written, it's static.
Poems must be seen and not heard, right?
Yes, right. Or heard only under specific circumstances.
Right.
And just in terms of how do you create and procreate, I mean, I think for so many people, and certainly for myself, so much of it also comes down to time and how you perceive that you own your time. And then when you have children, you just don't.
Yeah.
And so this question of when do I have my time to do the thing I need to do to feed myself? It's always there. So it's hard to not see these two wonderful things in opposition to each other, like creating art and raising children.
You know, I love that idea that somehow what separates the created poem from the procreated child is like some sense of autonomy on the part of the child. And another sort of, you know, another idea that I come back to in my own thinking about poetry is this idea of the poem obtaining autonomy somehow on its own. Like it somehow does, maybe not in the same way that a human being does, but it does.
I mean, it's kind of that it's kind of that once it's out in the world, it is autonomous, that once it's interacting with an audience, it has its own life with that audience.
Mm-hmm. Or even with an editor, you know, in the case of your book, right? So like the poems become autonomous through another person compiling them in a way.
That's true, yes. Right. I mean, it's funny when you and I were talking before you started recording, you said, you know, maybe you should read this and this. And I was saying, do you have my book in front of you? Can you find what page that's on? And just
right.
The idea that I don't know what page it's on. Like, I don't.
Right.
And yeah, so it's like this stuff it's become its own thing without me. And it's even found its own order without me.
That's lovely to think about that in the same conversation as creation versus procreation. And now that we're on the subject of the poems that you did read, one question that just popped into my mind as you were reading, and having set up the fact that these poems were originally drafted in three separate categories, I'm just curious. These are poems, the poems that you read were poems that I requested. I'm just curious, how do they distribute across those three original categories?
Oh, great question. Of the ones you asked me to read, there's nothing from the sort of historical category.
Interesting.
Everything you asked for me originally, was in the fairy tale or the contemporary category.
Very interesting. And that says probably something more about me than it does about you or your book.
It might. Yeah, I don't know.
Do you mind talking for a minute about the governing myth in the book? You know, so we've got Hansel and Gretel as sort of one of those fairy tale through lines throughout. And just as I understand the story of Hansel and Gretel, there's so much about tracing back in Hansel and Gretel.
Yes.
So much about like, again, like a dangerous sort of, you know, there's a danger at the center of this tracing back somehow. Can you just talk for a minute about like the inherent qualities of both threat and home, and the quality of tracing back that may be inherent in your decision to use the Hansel and Gretel myth?
Yes, thank you. That's a really, I love the way you phrase that, and I'm taking some quick notes because I want to keep thinking about that even beyond whatever I say right now. So a couple of things come to mind with the way you asked that. So speaking of the poems I see in as more historical, I was very interested in the question of silences in a family and how a family cannot talk about certain things, and yet those things come through. They pass on through the generations, whether they're talked about or not. And so how do secrets get transmitted, either on a conscious or an unconscious level? And so the idea of like going back and looking for things that you may not want to see, but you, kind of on some level, you've always known were there, whether you were ready to see them or not. So I think that's one impulse within Hansel and Gretel that resonated with me in terms of the going back and finding things. But the other thing that really interests me about that story, so when I first started using it as kind of a governing myth, as you put it so well, I was thinking that I was interested in the differences between a girl's response and a boy's response to a crisis, and that in the end, it's Gretel who saves them, but she does it by playing dumb. And I found that really interesting as like, here's a strategy that girls learn for success in life is to pretend that they don't know how to do things. And so she says to the witch, you know, I don't know how to test the oven, you know, can you test it for me? And then pushes her in there. And so by feigning ignorance and then showing her power. So that's what originally interested me. But the more I wrote these poems, the more I realized I was actually writing about parents and children. And I was writing about these kids who are in a place where they can't go home. They set it up so that they can return home. But in the original story, they do get back home successfully once. They leave stones on the path, and the stones reflect moonlight, and that's what helps them find their way back. And then the second time, they're not given enough prep time. It's kind of sprung upon them that they're going to be taken out into the woods, and so all they have is the bread. But the tragedy for them of, they really, do you want to go back to this house? Like, is this really the safe place for you, or the good place for you? And so they are forced to fend for themselves. And then when they do go home, it's sort of a happy ending because mysteriously their stepmother has died in the intervening, you know, time that they were away. But there's still this father who was complicit in pushing them out of the house. And just that uneasiness of, well, here's your happy ending, but is it really a happy ending? And I think that's something I also wanted to explore, is kind of the myth of the home as the safe place and as the place that you always want to return to. And if you don't have home to return to, then what do you have? I think that's at the root of a lot of the poems, even the ones that aren't explicitly about Hansel and Gretel.
Right. No, that strikes me as right as well. I'm thinking about the first poem you read, Under the Roof, which is this image of domesticity or house, you know. But somehow as we move through the poem, we arrive at this sort of this like space of abyss almost, or this space of alien sort of unknowability. And so in other words, there is at the heart of the home, as this poem proposes, there is something perhaps something secret, perhaps something unfamiliar or defamiliarizing. And that strikes me as perhaps one of the great tasks that this book puts before itself, is to plumb that gap, that alien quality that exists in the house, that secret. Can you maybe as just like a parting word, perhaps expand on that a little bit further by addressing maybe how this is resolved or developed upon? Do we have some sense by the end of the collection, or do you have some sense in the value of troubling home? Is there a value in doing that?
That's a good question. I mean, I think my original simplistic impulse, which was not at all right, and I knew it wasn't right, was that where does this all end? Well, it ends in a baby. That it ends in this hope for the future and, you know, the new creation that makes it all right. But I think that where it really ends is just in another iteration of the cycle, and maybe it's slightly shifted, but how, you know, how does the parent who was a child become the parent of the child who, you know, who may also receive some of this feeling of unsettling, you know, or of being unsettled? And what are, you know, what are the secrets and mysteries, you know, just talking in my own real life, like what are the things that I'm passing on unwittingly mm-hmm. to my own children? And I think that's another question that I'm asking over and over in the book is, you know, even before birth, what am I passing on? And then once they're born, what am I passing on? I have a poem in the book called Child Story, which is in some ways a found poem because it contains a story that my son told me, and I wrote it down as he told me. So I use his words and his phrasing in the parts that are in his voice. And then in the intervening spaces, I'm responding to him just in my thoughts. And at first, as I heard him tell this story, and it's a story about a boy who goes out on an adventure after his mom says no journeys, and then a lion eats the boy, and then the mom comes to get him and she tells the lion to eat her also. At first I thought, wow, this is crazy. You know, why is my son coming up with such awful stories? And then I just, you know, take a step outside myself and thought, oh, of course, like, who does he get this from?
Right,
you
right.
know, he gets it from me. And so, you know, unwittingly, these things will just get passed on and passed on. So in terms of resolution, I think the resolution is just that it's another cycle.
Right. No, I love that idea that, you know, we think of inheritance as something that happens wholly connected with the home, with the domestic,
yeah.
right? Inheritance is domestic. And yet what you're saying and what this book claims so beautifully is that what's inherited is actually, you know, the journey, the cycle, the leaving, the disturbance of home. You know, I'm looking at the back of the book, and again, going back to that Sasha West blurb, home will never look the same again. You know, and in some ways, that's what we inherit. We inherit a disturbance of home, which
yes.
strikes me as terribly bittersweet. So.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you know, Emily, thank you so much. It was a pleasure being able to speak with you again. It was a rich experience for me.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your thoughtfulness about my work.
You've been listening to the Colorado Review podcast, which can be found on iTunes and at Colorado Review's website, coloradoreview.colostate.edu. Also online, you can find selections from recent and archived issues of the journal, blog posts, reviews, and much more. This podcast is made possible by Colorado State University and the Center for Literary Publishing. Thanks for listening.